This podcast is an unedited excerpt from an MCLE program presented at MCLE's Conference Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Please note that MCLE's products, services, and communications are offered solely as an aid to developing and maintaining professional competence. The statements in this recording may not apply to your circumstances, and no legal, tax, accounting, or other professional advice is being rendered by MCLE or its speakers. For full terms and conditions, please see the MCLE website.
And now we're going to start moving into some trial-specific issues or some things that will come up really at the moment of trial.
Okay, so one of the main issues to come up at trial is identification of the defendant. And prior to Creighton, witnesses who had not made an out-of-court identification were permitted to make an in-court identification of the defendant sitting at the defense table next to his or her defense attorney. And the court finally in Creighton determined that that was absolutely, understandably so, way too suggestive. It's only reasonable that a witness on a stand, when asked if they could identify the person that they observed as the assailant or suspect, whatever might be, as the defendant sitting at the defense table, the only person in the court accused of the crime sitting next to a defense attorney. There's so many reasons you can articulate as to why that would be considered and is considered suggestive. And so the court said that the Commonwealth may not use or introduce an in-court identification by the eyewitness without this prior out-of-court identification that has already been made, unless there is good reason. So if there is a photo array, if there is a show up, a bring back, other out-of-court identifications that have already been litigated and decided and determined to be not suggestive and therefore admissible, the witness will be permitted to make an in-court identification now of the defendant. However, if that does not occur, the Commonwealth can still try to get an in-court identification in and admitted at the trial if there's good reason for it. And you can see that I provide some examples of what the good reasons would be. One of the primary examples is parties who are known to each other, right? Two individuals that are in a dating, intimate partner relationship are going to be individuals who are known to each other. That person who is the complaining witness is going to be permitted to identify the defendant because that is someone who is personally known to them. In some way, friends, family, in some instances, even acquaintances. If there's an officer who has witnessed the crime or had a substantial opportunity to be with the defendant at the time of arrest, these individuals will be permitted to make this in-court identification. Those things that cannot be considered good reason for admitting this in-court identification without a prior out-of-court identification are things such as the reasons that justify an out-of-court show-up or a bring-back. So, you know, in the immediate aftermath of a crime, if a suspect is arrested and they're brought back to the scene or the witness is brought to them, things that can be argued is that there's a concern for public safety because there was some sort of violent nature to the crime. There's a need for efficient investigation, right? The idea that they want to apprehend a suspect as quickly as possible. Additionally, prompt confirmation of information. There is also the argument that you want to be able to essentially set loose anybody who is innocent. And so those identifications need to happen in that immediate aftermath so that if the person is innocent, they can be released. Those, however, are not good reasons for arguing why an in-court identification should show up, because obviously those reasons don't exist at the time of the trial. So they can't be used to justify doing an in-court identification when there's been no out-of-court. The burden is on the prosecution. It is solely on the prosecution initially to move in limine to admit this identification. But once it is filed, that motion is filed, and best practice is to file it on everything. File it for police officers, file it for civilian witnesses. The defendant then bears the burden of demonstrating that the in-court identification would be unnecessarily and impermissibly suggestive. Another practice tip is we're very fortunate in the criminal bar to have a very sort of collegial relationship. Talk to the attorneys ahead of time. Figure out what they would be challenging. If they're certainly not going to challenge your civilian witness making an in-court identification because they're parties who are known to each other in some way, whatever it might be, you might be able to just make an oral motion at the time so it's on the record. But you want to talk to attorneys ahead of time, find out what they may or may not be challenging. Similarly with an officer, if they're not challenging it and you simply want to make an oral motion, and you know that counsel's in agreement and will stipulate to that, it's great to just put it on the record, but you don't have to go through the process of creating motion. I did, with the materials, give you different motions from both the defense and the prosecution side. They can certainly, obviously, and should be altered to fit the circumstances of your cases, but they're fairly boilerplate and address the more common ones that we see with respect to civilian witnesses and police officer witnesses. And so, as I said, it's best practice to file them, but in the interim, have them ready to go, and in the interim, talk to defense counsel. And that's just practical in the sense of keeping things moving with the courts, especially in the district courts. The next case for identification is Commonwealth v. Collins, and this stands for the bright line rule that where witness prior to the trial has participated in out-of-court identification but failed to identify the defendant unequivocally and positively, an in-court identification will be permissible, again, only where there is good reason for it. But this good reason will not often exist. It's very, very hard to justify. It usually requires a showing that the in-court identification is now somehow more reliable than the earlier failed identification, and that it poses little risk of misidentification. In this instance, there were witnesses who were shown a photo array, and one of them said it could pass for the suspect. I'm 75% sure. And a second witness, when looking at it, was asked to see the photos of the individuals from the side, just so to see a profile picture, which the officers could not accommodate. And the court said that these, at the time, one of the witnesses was permitted to identify the defendant at the table, and the court said that that was impermissible. And pardon me, that's because the danger of allowing these in-court identifications where the party, the witness, has made an out-of-court but not, an unequivocal positive identification may cause the jury to completely disregard or minimize that prior out-of-court identification and put too much weight and an improper weight on the in-court identification, which, as I just discussed, for so many different reasons, is really, truly suggestive. And in allowing a witness to do that, there's the added danger that now, because they feel they've been able to successfully identify the witness, they somehow become more confident in their recollection of the crime and the things that happened. It sort of changes the way they testify and almost improperly bolsters their credibility because it inflates their confidence. So that's another risk that it can create. So for those reasons, this identification will not be permitted. And in this instance, it will be much harder to find good reason to justify admissibility of it. Burden is, again, the same as under Creighton on the prosecution to file the motion in limine. And then that burden shifts once again to the defendant, who has to show that it is unnecessarily suggestive and there is no good reason for it, and probably will be easier in these occasions under Collins to do so.
So now we're moving on to Commonwealth versus Lumen Martin. This is a case that I think people are very familiar with and understand the broad outlines of it, but some of the nuances of Lumen Martin often are not really seen by the court. I would say that this comes up both in trial and also in pretrial hearings like the grand jury matters. You'll see Lumen Martin is something that you need to be familiar with. If you take duty days in Superior Court and you get appointed on witness representation issues. If you're in district or superior, you might get called in to represent a witness on a trial fifth. Lumen Martin really is the number one case you need to be familiar with. And it's often misunderstood by the court. It's been my experience that many judges want to go right to a Lumen Martin hearing whenever there's a fifth. And I'm going to walk you guys through sort of why that's not right and what you need to be looking out for. So in the case itself, the question that went up to the court was whether compelled testimony at a grand jury operated as a waiver of your fifth at trial. And through this question of, well, this witness testified before, but now, you know, they're saying they have a fifth, the court establishes a protocol or a procedure to allow for an in-camera hearing with a judge to make sure that a fifth is properly asserted. And as an initial caveat, I'll say if you find yourself having an actual proper Lumen Martin hearing at sidebar, you should be you should rest assured that the only proper use of that sidebar hearing is for appellate lawyers later on reviewing the validity of the fifth. So it feels very uncomfortable. Sometimes it feels like it happens very casually and quickly, and all of a sudden the judge wants your client to talk at sidebar and talk about why they have a fifth and what criminal activity they were up to that night. And you'll feel really uncomfortable, but you should know it's not permissible for the Commonwealth to access that and use it against your client. It's not permissible for, you know, someone investigating the case later on to go pull it. It's very private, protected recording material that really only gets used in an appeal if someone thinks that a fifth was fabricated or sort of inappropriately found or inappropriately denied. Then an appellate lawyer and the appeals court might review that hearing, but it's not going to be up for grabs in the trial court. That all being said, this is not really the usual route, the route of having this in-camera hearing. In Lumen Martin, it's made very clear that the whole point of having this hearing is for when a fifth is not readily apparent. If the facts or circumstances of the case make it obvious that there's a fifth and the prosecutor isn't contesting a fifth, but is more like, hey, I brought this victim in of a home invasion. It's clearly a drug rip. Clearly he's dealing coke. They ripped it off and you know, invaded and pistol whipped him. He's here to testify the grand jury. He's asserting a fifth. You all know what the fifth is. No one's surprised. No one's confused. No one's saying, is there a fifth? No, there's obviously a fifth. But sometimes what happens is the judge will bring you up and say, all right, we're going to have a Lumen Martin here and put the fifth on the record. No, ma'am, that is not what you're supposed to do. When there's an obvious fifth from its face, the question is, does your client assert it? If your client asserts it, it's obvious. The court accepts it. The fifth is now asserted. The Commonwealth can move towards immunization or a cooperation agreement or whatever means they want to try to do to get that person's testimony. But the point of the entire fifth process is that your client is protected and that whatever useful information they may or may not have for the Commonwealth, that they're not sinking their own ship in the process of that investigation. So it's really to protect that person, and the court should not be skeptical of their fifth unless the fifth is really speculative or unclear on the face. And that's what Lumen Martin, you know, created, was this opportunity to say, okay, defense has information, their client has information, the court doesn't have it, and the prosecution doesn't have it. And maybe there's a situation where someone is walking down the street and they're robbed at knife point and they're a victim. And they come in and say, I have a fifth. And the Commonwealth says, really? Well, okay, I'll get you a lawyer. You talk to them and you're like, oh yeah, he's got a fifth. But the court can't tell what it is. The Lumen Martin hearing is so that in that circumstance, you can, and this is the language, open the door a crack to make the privilege apparent to the court. And that's when you go up and say, judge, that money that was robbed off of him, he just robbed it off a bank. No one was seeing that coming, right? But you've got to make the court know, if he's questioned, where were you coming from? You know, why were you on the street that night? It's going to open up this exposure for him. And that's why he needs his fifth recognized, asserted, and then the Commonwealth can decide if they're going to take a gamble immunizing a fifth they don't know about. But that's what the Lumen Martin protocol is for, is to make a safe space for you to shine a light on an obscure or non-obvious fifth. It's not appropriate to jump right into that when the fifth is obvious on the face. And furthermore, another thing about Lumen Martin that's great is that there's a lot of times where a judge or even a prosecutor thinks the fifth is really thin and not a realistic concern, and that is not the inquiry. If the only fifth is that your victim of a stabbing, you know, was carrying a little bump of coke on him, it's still a fifth. And the whole point of the fifth is it's not to preclude, I mean, really the case law and the judges and the court, they're not trying to get people out from testifying. That's not what the point is. The point is, you should not be put in a position where you're forced to cooperate in an investigation and thereby give evidence against yourself, even if it's very unlikely that you would ever be prosecuted. So the language talks about how the privilege afforded not only extends to answers that would in themselves support a conviction, but likewise embraces those which would furnish a link in the chain of evidence. And a link in the chain of evidence is a phrase you need to kind of push into your brain and regurgitate when you're on the spot. It's got to be a link in the chain. A link in the chain could be he was living in that house in which drugs were found. A link in the chain could be he was driving a car that was later involved in a shooting. It doesn't have to be that the police or the Commonwealth thinks your guy's the driver or that he's the guy dealing drugs. But if he's going to implicate himself in any way, you know, he has the right to assert that fifth and be protected. And I wrote down here a little cautionary, be careful, because there are times I've heard people sort of say like, oh, well, you know, we've decriminalized her. Oh, that's not a crime in mass. Or, oh, they would never prosecute her for that. Like, sure, she might have slapped her boyfriend, you know, before he beat the crap out of her, but they're not going to, she's the victim. They're not interested. That's not the inquiry. If there's any world in which this person could be prosecuted, you have an obligation to raise that to them. Now, they can waive their fifth. They're not, and this happens a lot where you do a fifth inquiry with a victim who says, okay, I'm not worried about slapping him before he choked me and strangled me. I have a good relationship with the DA. I'm not concerned about it. She knows. I want to waive it. As long as you've advised her and told her, okay, well, just so you know, you could still assert it and maybe they would immunize you, but you know, you want to be protected. And she's like, nope, I'm good. I'm good with the situation. That's her right. Everyone has the right to waive their fifth, but you have the obligation to really make sure that you're explaining very clearly to the witness what the fifth is and that they're taking all this into consideration and making a knowing waiver of their fifth. And there are a lot of situations where everyone knows this person's not getting prosecuted, but you just need to make sure that you've counseled them and they understand their options before they make an informed decision to waive the fifth or not. And there are things that maybe, you know, are nebulous and not very obvious or a little unclear. I've had situations where I think there's a fifth because I think someone's arguably involved in sort of a criminal enterprise that has RICO implications. And yeah, they're not the target of this state investigation, but if they testify in the grand jury, could they be opening themselves up to federal prosecution if this entire gang goes down in a RICO, you know, investigation? You need to keep that stuff in mind as well. And I'm not saying you should think every possible anything ever is a fifth. Just be critical, be skeptical, ask questions. Don't just walk in, oh, she's gonna have a fifth. Do you think we're doing anything illegal at night? No, cool, good. She's good to go. You need to have a real productive conversation. Another practice point, particularly in superior court, but also in district court, in sort of messy emotional cases that are there for trial, is you have the right to tell the court, I cannot make this determination today and I cannot properly advise my client. I need the grand jury minutes, I need to see the report. I once had a fifth in district court where it was a like a fight basically, but the motivation for it was a homicide in superior court. And I just could not get a handle on what was going on with the parties. And I was told by defense counsel, like, you can, you know, because they're the one to alert the court, hey, this witness, I think they have a fifth, that this witness is implicated in a homicide connected to this fight. And so I'm like, whoa, I cannot make this determination today. I need to be able to call the victim witness advocate, call the DA who's prosecuting the homicide. I need to get a handle on what his exposure is on the murder and if there's this active grand jury investigation before he testifies and creates a motive for this guy being shot later, right? There are times that you need to step it back and ask for time. The court never likes that. They're trying to push you to go, go, go. They want to move on with their trial list or their grand jury matters. But, you know, there are times, and it's not every time, it's not even necessarily that frequently, but there are times where you really need to say, I'm sorry, I know this is inconvenient, but I need time to meet with my client in a private space. I need time to review the materials. I need to, you know, really advise them of this fifth and step it back. And I've done that a couple times and, you know, the court never loves it, but usually if you can articulate why you need that, they will accommodate you. And in that moment, that witness is your client. Your loyalty is to them. Doesn't matter what the court's trying to do. You need to make sure they're protected. And I will say, if you shepherdize or sort of look at the Lumen Martin cases that come out of it, there are some cases that get into the nitty gritty of sort of nebulous fifths, but this is really the place to start. And it's the case that judges are familiar with, and you could even keep a copy of it in your bag on a duty day and know that you have it there if you need it.
Annie, can I just step in for 1 second about Lumen Martin? You know, as a prosecutor, when there's a Lumen Martin hearing, I make it my practice, because our desk, at least in Superior Court, is usually closer. I not only step all the way back, but I actually believe it's supposed to be a closed courtroom hearing, which, quite frankly, most judges don't do, because they don't want to take the time to get everybody out of the courtroom or whatever like that. But as prosecutors, we want to make sure that there's like no chance, no appearance of impropriety that we can somehow hear, especially on, you know, as Annie alluded to, the thing that we're like, we don't really think this person has a fifth, like, you know, so I would make that, you know, part of your practice, that if there's a Lumen Martin hearing, just leave the courtroom. It's just a lot easier. And then two other things on this is that, you know, as prosecutors, you know, we'll get a defense attorney speaks to a witness and like, yeah, they've got a fifth. And I'm like, I understand that. We still need to go through this whole process, because it's actually the court that actually needs to take the, you know, assertion of that fifth. And so, you know, let's all make sure that our practice on both sides is, you know, making sure that we're doing our part to make sure that the court does everything that the court is supposed to do. But also, you know, Annie raises a great point that it's, you know, anything that would furnish a link in the chain of evidence, planning on going into the grand jury or trial and lying, well, I'm going to get up there and I'm not going to tell the truth, that's not a fifth. And, you know, and there are a lot of people who think that that might be a fifth. Like, I'm going, you know, I'm going to be charged for perjury because I'm going to go up there and lie. Like, your intent to do that is not a fifth. And, you know, I would keep that in mind, and you may need to find yourself pushing back on, you know, a court that reads very clearly that witness, and likely for very good reason, does not want to participate in a criminal case, but that is not a valid fifth. And we need to make sure that we're pushing back. Now, that being said, if a judge comes out and says this person has asserted their fifth, you know, it puts the Commonwealth sometimes in a difficult position, because the only fifth that we think that we know of is this intention to lie. So I guess my practice point would be, as Annie said, is like, let's make sure that we're taking the time and making sure that the court is doing everything that it's supposed to do to make sure that everything is, you know, just the procedure is properly followed.
Right. And I think in that situation, if you're a DA and you have this sort of niggling belief that maybe the fifth was improperly perjury, that's when maybe your appellate counsel is going to make a motion to review the fifth recording. Like, that's when you might be able to crack open that door. But I agree with Lynn, you know, obviously perjury is not the blocker. And this is a practice point that, you know, comes up more in Superior Court than in District Court, but you might have to have a frank conversation with a witness who doesn't really have a fifth, or has a fifth that is obvious and is going to be immunized. But that does not mean that they will never be called to testify, immunized, and put on the stand. And you might have to have a very frank conversation about contempt, what that looks like, what their options are. And there are witnesses who will take a contempt charge rather than testify for safety reasons, for all kinds of reasons. But as your lawyer, your job is not to judge them or to push them in one direction. It's to advise them and help them understand, you know, the kind of pressure that they're under, their options, and help them make an informed decision. You know, so sometimes these are uncomfortable conversations, really. They really can be. All right, so moving on to Edwards. So Edwards is a really interesting case, I think, because in Massachusetts, we had a common law sort of acknowledgement, but never a formal adoption of forfeiture by wrongdoing until Edwards. There had been cases where a witness in a robbery ends up murdered, and it's like, you know, very clear the defendant had a hand in it, and so obviously the testimony at grand jury came in against him. So when the court is looking at Edwards, the court sort of says, well, you know, interestingly, we've had these cases specifically with murder, threats, intimidation, like actual action to prevent a witness from testifying. But Edwards is a very different fact pattern and led the court to formally adopt forfeiture by wrongdoing. In Edwards, there had been a shooting. The victim of the shooting was reluctant from day one, had been very clear at grand jury and interviews. He didn't want anything to do with the case. He didn't want anything to do with the prosecution. I don't want to come. I'm not going to come. I'm not going to be there. Irrespective of the expressed wishes of that victim that he had been telling everyone who would listen, the defendant was also having recorded conversations in the jail with multiple friends and family members about ways in which the victim could avoid testifying. Well, you know, what if he did this? Or maybe he could do that. And, you know, it's possible that this would have let him, like, you know, get out of there. Maybe he could just move to Maryland. In that situation, when the Commonwealth got his jail calls, the Commonwealth made the argument that he was colluding with the victim to prevent him from appearing at trial. No one was alleging that he was forcing the victim not to come, or that he was mandating or threatening or, you know, even paying off the victim, just that he shared in this desire with the victim. And the court said, you don't even have to find that the collusion was, like, successful, that he convinced him, that he had an actual impact on the victim's decision-making. The defendant tried to say, it didn't matter what I might have been speculating about. He already wasn't coming. The court said, well, that doesn't matter, because if you're trying to engage in the collusion, in collusion with the victim or with his family members or with people who know him to convince him or help him or encourage him not to come, that alone implicates forfeiture by wrongdoing. So I think with Edwards, it's a case you want to know about, be aware of, if forfeiture by wrongdoing comes up in your case, because obviously we all know if your client murders a witness, like, obviously the grand jurymen are coming in, that's very clear, but this is a little bit more gray and complicated. And I think there are a lot of cases where people are making phone calls and saying things. I will say that Edwards, again, this is always fact specific, is good to look at, because he's not just saying, I wish he didn't come to trial. He's actually trying to, like, get messages to him or sort of imply that people might be able to find out or figure things out, or, you know, let him know that he could, you know, they can't get a capias if he's out of state, you know, that kind of thing. If all your client does is say, like, God, I hope he doesn't come to trial, that's probably not enough. You know, it's got to be a little bit more than that, but it doesn't have to be an actual directed impact on his decision making. The collusion alone is enough. So Edwards is a kind of a scary case for us as defense counsel, but something you want to be aware of and prepared to deal with should you have any regrettable jail calls that you need to contend with.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about adjutant. And I think probably maybe everybody on here knows that, you know, this is sort of the seminal case in regards to self-defense and first aggressor. Again, I think knowing the facts of a case are very helpful to sort of just be able to understand why the court was addressing this particular issue. The defendant was a masseuse, we'll go with. She had gone over to the victim's house to give him a massage. There was a question of whether or not there was going to be payment for sex, and the two of them begin fighting. But just the two of them are in the room, and so it's unknown who started what. But what we did know was that the victim hit the defendant with a crowbar. The defendant hit the victim twice, or stabbed the victim twice with a knife. And then eventually there's a fatal stab by the defendant to the victim in the neck, and that's what kills him. And the defendant was not allowed to produce this evidence of basically that when the victim gets drunk, he's particularly violent, he's particularly aggressive. There had been observations of him earlier that night where he was drunk, he was making unwanted sexual advances to other women in the area. And that evidence was not brought in, and the court said that the defendant was prejudiced by leaving it out, because it would have made a difference to that jury knowing that this evidence was out there. But I think what's really important for everybody, defense or prosecution, to know is that when self-defense is asserted, first of all, you need that first prong. Somebody needs to actually allege that they were acting in self-defense. But the issue of a first aggressor needs to be in dispute. And I think that people on both sides don't necessarily address that prong. And there are people who think, well, you know, my guy acted in self-defense because everybody knows that that defendant is a violent guy. And here are the 16 police reports where this person was violent and everything like that. But in a lot of self-defense cases, you know, the Commonwealth, for example, might be just arguing excessive self-defense, or, you know, it may be a manslaughter in a first degree. But the question of first aggressor is not in question. The evidence would come out that, you know, the victim did something, and then, you know, the defendant responded. And so the question really is, you know, by the Commonwealth, is that have we gotten over our burden of proving that the person did not act in self-defense? I would actually say that while certainly throughout the discovery phase, you may go back and forth as to, you know, what the parties are entitled to, you know, my personal, and I'm not going to speak for anybody else, my personal practice is that, you know, if there are prior police reports of my victim, here you go. All right, here you go. But at the end of the day, it's inadmissible, because I know that, you know, my victim did something first. Before you sort of find yourself gung-ho about, you know, what a bad, violent person the defendant is, really make sure that you've got that prong, because you're going to find yourself, you know, going down a road that you won't be able to go down.
I would also add into this, Lynn, because this is a really good practice point, that from the defense perspective, adjutant is so lovely and great and fun when you're arguing bail and motions. And then at trial, you have to get all the people in to testify about what that victim did. And I forget that until I had a self-defense trial where Sandy Gant and I were in Norfolk, and we had 9 adjutant cases, and we could only find one witness to come in, and it was like a tepid punch. And we were sort of like, you know, just didn't hit the way we hoped it had. But if you can't get witnesses in, if you can't put on, you have to actually call witnesses about this person.
Yeah, those police reports aren't coming in.
Right. So it's like things might look very good for you on paper, but when you're prepping for trial, you need to also be trying to locate those people and interview them and make sure the juice is worth the squeeze, for the same reason that if you open the door to adjutant, the Commonwealth can rebut with your client's record. And if all you're getting is one little swing punch and your client is involved in 2 shootings, is it worth it? Probably not. So, you know, that's like a practical thing that really never occurred to me until I found myself in the position of trying to herd cats.
I'd like to talk now a little bit about Commonwealth v. Soares, and we'll add this to the now very probably long list of cases in which everybody knows the name of it. I would say even most people would even know the holding and sort of what line of cases it goes down, but you might not know the facts. And so let me just give you very briefly, the Harvard football team back in 1976 had a dinner at the Harvard Club, and they had some drinks, and then all of them leave in all sorts of different cars. There's 6 people in one van, and there's other people who are getting home another way or whatever. And there's a bunch of football players who are in one of the motor vehicles. I think it was a van. And they have an encounter with 2 black women who they have a conversation with. There's some discussion of whether or not there's going to be some sexual favors. That interaction ends. The 2 women go down the street, and one of the football players realizes that his wallet is missing. And so all of them believe that one of these women took the wallet, and they all give chase. And it's, you know, that car plus the other car. I mean, it starts to involve quite a few people. And they get up to one of the women. They grab her arm. She falls down. She gets picked up. She ends up running away. But sort of in this, what starts with this melee, because there are, quite frankly, so many people, is that there are a couple of Black gentlemen who are nearby, and they involve themselves, and it basically turns into the Black males and the white football players, you know, getting into it, and one of the football players ends up getting stabbed and killed. And so we had it at trial. We had three Black defendants and a white victim. So that's sort of what we're starting with here. And what had happened was that the prosecutor had used peremptories on 12 of the 13 Black jurors. And that was challenged. And what the court in Soares said is that there's this two-part finding that the use, you know, the court does presume that the use of a peremptory challenge is constitutional and proper. Okay, so, but the way that you can disprove that is that there's this pattern of conduct that has developed whereby several prospective jurors who have been challenged peremptory are members of a discrete group, whether that is race, et cetera. And there is a likelihood that they are being excluded from the jury solely by reasons of their group membership. There was no other thing that anybody could point to say that that's why they were being excluded from sitting on this jury. There was no other reason. There was no other reason. And I would say, having had this issue come up, having read these cases for the purposes of these, for this presentation, even though, quite frankly, all of the case law goes to prosecutors not acting legally or ethically or morally, for whatever category you would like to put it in, this is something that is applied to both parties. And regardless of the case law sort of reading one way, everybody should know that it applies, it certainly applies to everybody. So the SJC in Soares says, hey, look, there's this two-part finding in order to make sure that people are properly impaneling jurors. And then the court in Sanchez says, hey, look, actually, and this is a recent case from 2020, it overruled Soares in part. So this presumption of propriety that, you know, people are properly using their peremptory challenges, they're rebutted when the totality of the relevant facts gives rise to an inference of discriminatory purpose. You no longer need to find that two-part finding that I just noted. But, you know, this is where we get, we've had for a while, but, you know, in that totality of relevant facts, this what's been referred to as the pattern of one. Just because a party moves to exclude, you know, the first Black juror, that doesn't mean that the opposing party can't prove that the totality of the relevant facts gives rise to an inference that you are excluding that juror purely for an improper improper purpose. And so, just like a quick practical a practice point, but you know, you have to make your record. And that's what's going to help you on appeal, regardless of what side you're on, right? Because the problem that the reviewing court, the appellate court, is going to have is that they're not sitting there with the venari in front of them. They don't necessarily can't say, well, we know that there have been white jurors that came before this person, that there have been Black jurors, there have been other people, persons of color, Have they been male? Have they been female? You need to make sure that your record reflects that venari so that the reviewing court has all of that information in front of it. When you challenge somebody, what's commonly referred to as a SORS challenge, that person, because you have, and you say like that this is the reason that this person is being challenged. If the court finds that there's reason to inquire of the party who has moved to preempt a juror, that party, the party that's has attempted to remove the juror, must give a reason that is both adequate and genuine. What you can sometimes get into a problem with this is that what do we do with implicit bias, right? What do we do in a sense where there's an attorney who's making what they believe to be a legitimate challenge, but really taken in the totality of the circumstances and everything that's going on, it really is, a challenge that's based on race or based on some other improper reason. So making sure that you are asking the right questions, that you are fleshing out all of these issues is going to allow the judge that needs to put on the record that they find, a reason both adequate and genuine is really going to help you when you're making your appeal later. Because I'll tell you right now, you have a mistake in your jury selection, that's a structural error. And regardless of anything else, that conviction is getting flipped. So please protect your record. Your appellate colleagues on either side will thank you for it. And then the last case having to do with this is Commonwealth v. Carter, which just came out. The site is there for you. I believe it was so new that I didn't even have I didn't have another site for it, right? So it says that sexual orientation joins the other protected classes for the purposes of Batson SORS challenges. And they made it express that it was prohibited under Articles 1 and 12. So this is a practice point that, quite frankly, the SJC, that came directly from the SJC, and said, well, we're going to tell you that, yes, it's a protected class and you can't challenge somebody on it, but we're also going to tell you you really shouldn't just be asking people what their sexual orientation is. Unlike something that arguably may appear apparent on the record and the parties, for example, could agree that somebody appears to be a person of color or, self-identifies as such during the questioning an individual voir dire, we should not be in the practice of asking people what their sexual orientation is. So the parties need to rely upon the facts and the record if determining if the person who's moving under Batson SORS challenge has reasonably established that prospective juror's sexual orientation has been a factor in this. So the last one is Flabot, pretty straightforward holding in child sexual assault cases. Upon request from either of the parties, a judge must ask each prospective juror as to whether or not they've been the victim of a childhood sexual offense. As somebody who has impaneled sexual assaults, I know along with all of my colleagues on this panel, it can be a very difficult conversation to have and a difficult question to ask, which is quite frankly why I appreciate that it comes from the judge as opposed to coming from either of the parties for that matter. But I think the main practice point to take from this, and I tell people all the time, is you really need to get from a judge what their preferred method of impanelment is. So you know, if you have a child sexual assault case and, you know, you want to request that they ask about that, that's all well and good. But let's also take it one step further in the fact that, judge, you know, do you alternate between preemptories? Are we doing individual voir dire? Are we doing panel voir dire? You know, what are we doing here? Because what you don't want to find is that you have sat 14 in the box because you've gone under, you know, Judge so-and-so's waive impanelment where you put everybody in the box and then you use preemptories. And this judge expects you to use preemptories before they're in the box. And everybody's different. And so you really need to make sure to protect, you know, your interests, the defendant interests, the Commonwealth's interests, that you know how a judge is going to be doing this impanelment, because it can come as a surprise when you think it's going one way and it's not. And judges will tell you, well, I do it differently. I do it like this. I make the Commonwealth use all of its preemptories before the defendant, or I go back and forth. I alternate, you know, those questions, and making sure that the judge has expressed that to you is incredibly important.
I will also note flabot should be done at sidebar. Most judges know this, but if they don't, you want to point that out. You're not going to get an honest answer in the raise your card thing. Though, you know, anyone who's done these cases knows most of the people self-identify very quickly. They come up crying. So this tends to be less contentious than you think it is, but it's very sensitive and you want to be sensitive to it.
Continuing with sex cases, King deals with first complaint and sexual assault cases. And this is codified in Rule 413 of the Massachusetts Rules of Evidence. So King tells us that testimony by the first person the complainant told of an alleged sexual assault is admissible at trial. Specifically, the fact that a first complaint of sexual assault was made and the circumstances surrounding making the complaint. So that can include, you know, what the complainant looked like or seemed like, observations of him or her while they're making the complaint of sexual assault, the events or the conversations that led up to this person making a complaint, or the timing of the complaint. The evidence is introduced for the limited purpose of assisting the jury in determining whether to credit the complainant's testimony. So it's not supposed to be offered by its truth. It seems like a difficult distinction to make, but a limiting instruction is required by King contemporaneously when the first complaint witness testifies, and again during the final instructions, to let the jury know that this testimony is just for that purpose and not to be taken for its truth. And then finally, with respect to this slide, only one first complaint witness is allowed to testify.
Okay. In terms of trial issues, one of the biggest things to be mindful of is whether or not there is sufficient evidence for the case to go to the jury for determination of whether it's been proved to them beyond a reasonable doubt. I can keep this fairly brief. Lattimore is very straightforward. That standard is whether the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth is sufficient for that, is sufficient to permit the jury to infer the existence of the essential elements. So for example, take an assault and battery. There was a touching, defendant intended the touching, and it was either likely to cause bodily harm or it was offensive. That jury instruction was revised in 2019. So prior to that, it was it likely to cause injury or done without the person's consent? And so something very simple as flicking somebody on the arm could technically be considered an assault and battery. Well, now that's certainly not likely to cause harm, and would it even be considered offensive? The Commonwealth has an ethical obligation in instances where it feels that it cannot prove all of the elements of the crime to get over that, past that Lattimore standard, to not move forward with the case. The evidence must be of sufficient force to bring the minds of ordinary intelligence to the persuasion of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It is an incredibly high burden, rightfully so, and it is a burden that the Commonwealth must meet, and the Commonwealth must know that it has the evidence to do so. And it does go beyond things such as just the elements. If the Commonwealth cannot not make an identification, other matters that play into proving the case to a reasonable doubt, beyond a reasonable doubt, then the Commonwealth under Lattimore has an obligation to not move forward with the case. I did provide in the materials a very, very boilerplate motion for required finding, which obviously can be doctored to fit the facts of the case. I know it's not easy to do last minute in court, but certainly when the court, when you expect the evidence to be insufficient, it's certainly possible to draft a motion as to why, present that to the court and simply.
Thank you.